Okay, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for February 3rd, 2011. We have a very interesting agenda today. We've got some informational updates. We're going to hear those first, and then we do have three bills that have come to us from various committees. So with a little bit of introduction here for our new members, which I will stop saying soon, because I know you guys are probably getting tired of hearing this, but I'm trying to provide background on some important issues that we'll be hearing throughout the session. And we had quite a bit of work last session on an issue around marine reserves and marine spatial planning. And so I've asked the Department of Fish and Wildlife and some of our Coastal Caucus members to come and provide an update on some of the great work that was done last session, work that was done in the interim, and then proposals that may be coming back to this legislative body during the session. And so we're very fortunate to have Representative Gene Cowan here as a representative of the Coastal Caucus. It's going to come up and give an introduction, and then we have some agency folks. Do I need to officially open up an informational meeting? So with that, I will open up an informational meeting on marine reserves. And welcome, Representative Cowan. Thanks for coming over.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, I am Jean Cowan. I am the state representative from House District 10, and also with my hat as chair of the Coastal Caucus this time around. So I wanted to do just a brief introduction to the presentation that you'll hear on the marine reserve planning to date and where we're going. The Coastal Caucus has seen this presentation several times, so I may not stay for it for its entirety, but we have reviewed it, and we've been an active part of the community teams who have been meeting in our respective communities over the past year to try to develop a limited series of marine reserves and marine protected areas that we can learn from, develop some additional data, scientifically based data, and also at the same time to protect the socioeconomic well-being of our coastal communities, which is very important to us as well. So our fishers have been at the table, both recreation and commercial fishers, as well as other representatives in the process of the community team's discussion. We said going into the process that if a decision came out of a community team that was a narrow margin, a 6-7, 5-7 split, that to us wasn't a clear directive, but that we were looking for broader consensus. And the presentation will tell you a little bit about how clearly we had consensus in some, perhaps a little less clearly until we did a little bit of adaptation, but we feel that they have come forward with a plan that will be workable and that represents the interests of the fishing communities as well, trying to keep some spaces that were highly productive areas, particularly crab, that would have been pretty tragic in our communities had they been unnecessarily impacted. So as far as where we will go procedurally from here, the Coastal Caucus collectively is in the process of developing a policy bill that will address the implementation of these and put some sideboards on the whole process. And that's under construction as we speak, so you can look forward to something coming forward probably from the House side, I would imagine, on that. So unless there are any other specific questions about where we go from here, for me, I will turn it over to the agency who will give you the detail.
Thank you, Representative. I do have one. Could you just explain for everybody who are the members of the Coastal Caucus?
Oh, certainly. I should have done that, and I'd be happy to. What we refer to collectively as the Coastal Caucus is a bipartisan, bicameral group of 9 legislators, both senators and representatives, who represent the coastal Oregon geographically, and then we let Senator Whitsett join us as well because of the Klamath Basin's impact on the fish that come to the sea.
And wannabe coastal call.
He's very helpful to the whole process. His science background is very helpful in the conversations as well. And we don't just occasionally lobby our friends and associates for a bill, but we do actually meet on a very regular basis. We met periodically during the interim, usually for at least half-day meetings, and during session we meet on a weekly basis in the only time slot available, which is 7 a.m. And so we are very committed to helping to tell the story of what our needs are in our coastal communities and to look at some of the issues that collectively impact us all.
Thank you. So
we hope we can provide information to all of you as we move forward.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your leadership. We'll look forward to working with you.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Next up, I'll ask the department to come up and provide an overview. I think you have a handout. Did everyone receive the handout PowerPoint? I don't know if you have a live PowerPoint as well or just a handout. Okay. Hopefully we won't have any technical difficulties. Yay.
There it is. Hey. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And we're very grateful for Representative Cowan, not only for the Coastal Caucus leadership on this, but also for helping set the stage today. So my introductory comments really will just skip over and get right to Anna Pakenham, who is one of the leaders of the Marine Reserves Program that is shepherding not only the public process, but also the implementation of this. And so I'll turn it over to her to carry on.
Thanks, Anna. For the record, my name is Anna Pakenham. I'm with ODF&W out of the Newport Field office.
And you may have to move your mic over just a little bit. Great.
Okay.
So we can hear you.
So just very quickly, thank you for this opportunity to provide a background on the Marine Reserves process. I'll quickly go through how did we get to where we are today, talk about our pilot site implementation, our evaluation sites recommendations, additional recommendations that came out through the process, and the next steps. So in March of 2008, Governor Kulongowski issued Executive Order 0807, kind of outlining the process and setting sideboards for the Marine Reserves process. He said that there shall be 9 or fewer sites along the coast. These sites should be ecologically meaningful while also avoiding significant and social and economic hardship, and that there shall be a public nomination process guided by OPAC, our Ocean Policy Advisory Council, and that the proposals that came forward from the public would be rewarded when they had a lot of stakeholder collaboration. So the public submitted 20 proposals to OPAC. They spanned up and down the coast and represented about 50% of the territorial sea. OPAC asked the agencies involved with this process to perform an analysis. And from this analysis, OPAC moved forward 6 sites as a part of their recommendations. 2 sites were considered pilot sites. This is at Otter Rock and Redfish Rocks. These 2 sites had a lot of community team support, had a lot of local buy-in, and had really undergone a long process to put forward their proposals. So they were the most developed, and these pilot sites were moved forward for designation. Then we had 3 sites for further evaluation. These were at Cape Falcon, Cascade Head, and Cape Perpetua. These sites required a little bit more community conversation and a little more in-depth analysis. And then finally, OPAC prepared a area for a new proposal at Cape Arago Seven Devils. And this process would be led by the International Port of Coos Bay, and it would be different than the pilot sites and the evaluation sites. So during the 2009 legislative session, the Coastal Caucus sponsored a bill, House Bill 3013, which said move forward with the OPAC recommendations, develop community teams for the evaluation sites to provide further recommendations on those 3 sites. ODF&W was put forward as a lead agency working with the Science and Technical Advisory Committee of OPAC, which are a group of scientists to provide scientific guidance, and also go back to OPAC for consultation, and then at the end of the year report back to the legislator. So briefly on what is happening with the proposal site at Cape Arago, this was a large area to consider developing new proposal. Like I said, it's being led by the International Port of Coos Bay, and ODF&W is providing support, but it is their own process. They've outlined how they're moving about it, and currently they have developed 4 options for consideration and will be making a community vote next month, which will go to the Port of Coos Bay. For our pilot sites, now these are the two that had further development and moving forward with full designation at Redfish and Redfish Rocks and Otter Rocks. The State Land Board, Parks, and ODFNW went through a rulemaking process last January. We have formed community teams and working groups that have been undergoing a lot of work with ODFNW. A lot of grants and contracts have been awarded to these teams and also to fishing vessels for work to be done in the areas. Management plans that have been developed for these sites, including biological and socioeconomic monitoring, education and outreach, and enforcement. Over the last year and a half, we've conducted baseline studies in both of these areas, and after the baseline studies are conducted, prohibitions at these sites will go into effect. So, again, we have three sites for further evaluation. This is at Cape Perpetua, Cascade Head, and Cape Falcon. The maps you see in front of you, the boundaries are the original OPAC proposed boundaries. This was the starting point for these community teams. We established three community teams, 32 members on each team. Eight stakeholder groups were represented. They had 11 months of facilitated meetings. They met 1 to 2 times a month for 3 to 4 hours each meeting. It was a large amount of community time and dedication. And starting with the OPAC boundaries, they're looking to see if there was a site here that was large enough to evaluate the ecological benefits, but also small enough to avoid that significant social and economic impact. And it was a very difficult task for them and a very difficult balancing act that they needed to perform. And then from there, they made their recommendations to us. And I can't say enough how much participation and input we had from these community teams and the amount of time and energy that went into this process. Over 25,000 community volunteer hours were put into these three sites alone. So we wanted to say thank you. So out of Cape Perpetua, the community recommended this site you see before you. It's outlined in blue. It has a marine reserve and marine protected areas and a seabird protection area. In purple is the original OPAC boundary, so you can see it has been modified. A marine reserve, just for background, is an area close to all extractive activity. An MPA, or marine protected area, has various levels of prohibitions and allowances, and those types of prohibitions and or allowances were defined by the community teams to suit their needs of that community. So there was a 15-to-1 vote here, very strong support, and this recommendation from the community team, ODFNW, continued on. And more details on each of those recommendations are in your handouts as well. This is the Cascade Head community team recommendation. There's a 12-to-4 vote in support of this site. It has a marine reserve and three different types of MPAs. The details, again, are in your handouts. And then the original boundaries are in purple from the OPAC. ODFNW, because of the strong community team support, moved forward and completed the community team recommendation as a part of ODFNW's recommendation. And then finally, Cape Falcon, the OPAC boundaries in purple. This is the ODFNW's recommendation. The community team did not, they voted on and supported a 9-to-7 vote on the original OPAC boundary, which you see in purple. And as Representative Cowan stated, we're really looking for a strong community team support or a strong vote. So ODFNW took the information gathered in the community team process and some of the compromises that were developed during that process and moved forward this recommendation that has a marine reserve and a combination of two MPAs. So what does this look like in terms of the system? We have sites that are in various levels of process from north to south. We have about 32 to 65 miles between sites. The distance to the nearest port to the north and south is approximately 16 miles. And in terms of what does that represent of the territorial sea, about 3.8% of the rock within the territorial sea is represented, and about 5.5% of the total territorial sea is represented within the marine reserves and complementary MPAs.
Anna, can you just go back for a minute? Mixed there means what?
Mostly gravel predominantly. So in addition to the site recommendations that were developed by the community team, ODF&W took input both from the community team process to develop additional recommendations to be associated with the site recommendations. The additional recommendations included a review and evaluation, so looking at the progress of these sites, how are we doing with our implementation, how are we doing with our monitoring. So we've recommended a 1-5 and a 10-15 year review or an evaluation. Another recommendation was if there were to be alterations of these sites, we would go back to a community team or the stakeholders to see consensus before any alterations would be made through a public rulemaking process. And another additional recommendation would that beyond these six sites, there would be no new sites north of Cape Blanco during the evaluation period. There is also an additional recommendation to commit to secure funding. If this funding could not be secured for the needs of this program, there would be a scale-down or suspension of fishing prohibitions. And then there would also be some guidelines on how non-state funding sources would be used to be consistent with our programs. Another recommendation would be community engagement in the implementation, either through community teams or community opportunities to engage in the process. A commitment to monitoring and research, so a baseline data collection and making sure that this is a scientifically based process prior to, and also baseline prior to prohibitions going into effect. And then mitigation, if there is a significant social and economic impact of these sites, ways to mitigate against that effect, either through local use of vessels, through research and monitoring, collecting of fishery independent data, or ways to reduce bycatch and mortality. So after we went through this year-long community team process, we took our recommendations and presented them to OPAC. This was another opportunity for the public to have input into the process. And OPAC looked at each of the sites and the additional recommendations and had a consensus support of the sites and additional recommendations as they actually modified them. So the additional recommendations you see in front of you are the ones that had been modified by OPAC and provided a letter to ODF&W in support of the process and the community teams and their work and our recommendations. And that is in your packet as well. So our next steps, we have the governor's recommended budget, which gives us approximately $1.7 million from the Measure 76 lottery funds, $1.2 coming out of the natural resource subaccount, about $500,000 from the park subaccount. We anticipate, as Representative Cowan said, that there will be a policy bill associated with the next steps and anticipate some sort of budget limitation for this program. If these three sites plus one go into effect, there will be rulemaking next winter by our three agencies. And after baseline data is collected, prohibitions would be going into effect. And I would be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Yeah, I will start off by just asking if you can. I know that you haven't been taking the lead on this. Can you talk a little bit about the marine spatial planning process and how that fits in with the work that you're doing? Or Ed,
sure.
If you'd like to answer that.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the marine spatial planning is kind of a term that's used, and it's caught a lot of traction federally right now for what's really looking at the challenges that are coming at our coast and figuring out how to comprehensively look at those in a spatial sort of context. So we have energy factors that are coming to bear both through wave energy and wind energy off the coast. There are port dredging issues. There are cabling, marine aquaculture, invasive species, a whole number of things that are coming to bear, really challenges for us to address on the coast. And there's a strong desire in our state, as well as California and Washington and federally, to get out ahead of some of these through basically comprehensively planning how these may fit together so that they're not competing interests on our coast or putting burdens on existing coastal marine uses such as fisheries. And one of the things, I should mention that a lot of the effort on this is through the Department of Land Conservation and Development, DLCD, and they are amending the territorial sea plan to include aspects right now of energy development. And so Oregon's approach hasn't been to take all this on comprehensively yet, but we're taking two big pieces. One of those is conservation, and that's the marine reserves piece as a start. And the other is energy development. And those are two key elements of marine spatial planning. First, you want to establish kind of a conservation foundation upon which you'll do other planning on top of that. And so marine reserves are just one element of that. And then the energy development is something that's very, very much in play right now, both through FERC and through you know, companies that are trying to develop the technology. And so those are being amended into the territorial sea plan through the DLCD process. We look that this will probably be expanded in the future for some of these other issues that are coming up.
Thank you. We have time for a couple of questions. Any questions, Senators? Senator House?
Madam Chair, I see these 10 to 15-year evaluations, and it makes me think these are permanent. So is there a time out there where somebody says we've done our job and these are no longer reserves, or what is the long term?
So the there is
move your mic a little bit
sorry.
Closer. Yeah.
Senator Dingfelder, Chair Dingfelder, and members of the committee. The hope of these is that we can learn from them. Are they an effective management tool, and do they work? And the 10 to 15-year time frame is there are long-lived species that potentially could have an effect from these marine reserves. And so the 1 in 5 and 10 to 15-year evaluation and review is to really say, are we implementing these correctly? Are we engaging our communities? And then the 10 to 15 years, are these working as individually and collectively as a system as an effective management tool? They may not in Oregon, and we want to be able to adaptively manage through time.
Question. Any other questions? Okay.
Madam Chair, if you can indulge me for a second, Representative Cowan asked me to also introduce, you may remember Anna Pakenham as a Sea Grant Fellow last session who worked with the caucus under Senator Johnson's office. And Zach Reeves is with us today, who is the new Anna, if you will, the Sea Grant Fellow working out of Representative Cowan's office to help out the caucus. And so I think he's here. Raise his hand.
Great.
All right. So
great.
He's at your all disposal through the caucus work.
Excellent.
Well, we'll look forward to working with all of you. Thank you very much for the thorough update, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more on
Thank
marine
you.
Reserves and marine spatial planning. Thank you. Okay, so I will close the informational meeting on marine reserves, and I'm going to open up another informational meeting on the overview of Pacific Northwest Economic Region. So they have requested to come here today and provide a brief overview of the Energy Horizon Institute, and I'm really pleased to have especially Representative Morris here from the state of Washington, who I've worked with over the years, and it's great that you were able to take a break and come down here, and maybe you can help us fill our budget hole, because I know you've got one too. Representative Mike Schaffler, I think, is going to do an introduction, and we also have Mike Morrison, who's Executive Director of PennMOR. So why don't you all come up, because we've just got about 15 minutes, including for time for questions, so we can get on to our bill hearing. So thank you, gentlemen.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for hearing us. And I know you're especially glad to see me, too, aren't you? I'm sure.
Always.
And we don't have a co-chair and co-chair over here. It kind of makes it a little easier, too. Mike Schaffler, Happy Valley, out of Southeast Portland, House District 48, Pacific Northwest Economic Region. I know you folks that have been around are familiar with it. It's 5 states, 5 provinces. It's been a great. I've been at it for 8 years. Karen Minnis appointed me. Gary Hansen's an alternate, and I've been going ever since. We talk about a whole lot of great stuff that this region has in common. It's a very wealthy region with not very many people, really, and with the global economy changing before our eyes, we have an opportunity to work together to all of our benefits. Representative Morris here put together this Energy Institute, and he's just done an incredible job with it. I have not had the opportunity to take it yet. Representative Witt and Representative Wingert did take it, and they got a lot out of it, and they really have been singing its praises for the last couple of days. So we're having our summit. Our annual summit is going to be in Portland this summer, July 19th through 22nd. I hope you can all make it. It meet a lot of folks from around the region, and I've learned so much from going to these meetings. It's incredible. So, thank you again, Madam Chair. I don't want to be rude, but I have to go. I'm already late. So, but thank you for the opportunity, and I look forward to seeing you at the summit.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for bringing these folks here today.
And we're going to fix the home brewing problem, Mr. Senator. I look forward to that too.
I do too.
Thank you. And Matt, do you want to come up? And if you could, one of the things, Representative, if you could just give a little bit of background on Penwar as well, because we do have some members that are new to the legislature, and I'm not sure that all the members are familiar with Penwar. So before you jump into the specifics about the Institute, if you can provide a little bit of background.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. And for the record, Jeff Morris from the 40th Legislative District in Washington State, which means nothing to anyone down here, but is San Juan Islands, Bellingham, and Anacortes part of the state. So I appreciate the marine spatial hearings. We're talking about that in Washington State as well. And first off, as far as the budget crisis goes, I came down because we've sent several emails about the $1 billion of Oregon money we found in Washington State accounts. If you would just send us the $100 million to release the money to you.
Is this a Nigerian account?
We'll release that when the Washingtonians that come over here to escape your sales tax and use our bottle bill.
Right.
But we'll talk about that later,
Well, thank you for the chance to come here today. The Pacific Northwest Economic Region is really a unique entity, really not only in North America, but really in the world. It's a statutory committee of the five Northwest states and the western provinces and territories of Canada, whereas we've jointly joined, and just like this is a committee of the Senate, Penwar is actually a joint committee of those legislatures in those different states and provinces. And it's unique in that it's a public-private partnership. And so the private sector participates, too, through a private sector council, in addition to the joint legislative council that oversees the management of the organization. Its goal is really to identify and promote economic development throughout the region. I usually say, this is my own take on it, that one of the main things we do is break down barriers within the region so we can all export our products out to the world market more efficiently. Sometimes when we have intra-regional squabbles, that keeps us from fully participating in the worldwide economy, and Penwar's been excellent at keeping some of those from happening, from getting off the ground. there's been a variety of delegates from Oregon over the years. It's a group that's had full participation, but it's really blossomed the last 10 years, and the organization's budget actually, I think, is easily quadrupled in that time. Mainly from private sector participation, because they're getting a great value out of the dialogue that happens regionally. And its topics are energy, agriculture, tourism, anything that has an economic development footprint are addressed at Penwar meetings during the summer summit in particular. Just to talk and be somewhat brief, I'm going to go through a very quick and 30,000-foot overview of the energy portfolio for Penwar, and also the Legislative Energy Horizon Institute. Invite any members here who would like to participate. We'd love to see you at the Institute as people get appointed over the next couple months to participate from Oregon. But the main thing, I'm not sure this PowerPoint is going to come up on the screen or not.
We have assistance coming over. But why don't you go ahead and then we'll...
So basically, every summer, Penwar has a very robust energy portfolio. We're basically kind of call it the Lollapalooza of energy events for the region during the summer. There'll be up to 200 energy infrastructure owners. Owners. And basically what they do is they triage within the region, not within a state or province, but within the region, what are the biggest challenges facing us from an energy perspective across the region. And since I've been involved in the last few years, particularly with this portfolio, we've done an economic study with Idaho National Lab over the cost of not building transmission from an economic loss to bring new renewables in the region online. We've dealt with identifying worker shortages for large energy projects throughout the region. region. We found over $55 billion of projects in Western Canada. In the five Northwest states, have $100 million or more only. There's not enough workers to do that work. That's something, in a recession, doesn't seem like it. But, for example, Alberta's been at full employment for quite some time now, and these worker shortages are starting to spread through the region, particularly for iron workers and so forth. The Institute was created because at the Vancouver Summit, folks identified that the fact that they've got complex energy questions that are before state legislatures now and provincial legislatures, that, you know, in Washington State, you know, we have folks who are flower shop owners and firemen one day, and the next day they're being asked to decide, you know, interconnection standards for distributed generation, which is a fairly complex issue to get into somehow that all works. So the solution was to put together this institute, which would quickly ramp legislators' knowledge level up of how the energy system actually works. We approached the U.S. Department of Energy and NCSL, National Conference of State Legislators, and they gave us seed money to kind of put together a proposed curriculum for an institute that would do that. Once we had that curriculum together, we approached some private sector partners who gave us the funding to actually put the institute on. And that was kind of the start of this as a pilot project targeting 35 Northwest legislators over the last 2 years. Here's the folks from the different states that participated. As was mentioned, we had two from the Oregon House. We had some folks appointed from the Oregon Senate, but the schedules didn't work out to have people participate. But this is the first class. As you can see, we had quite broad participation from the Northwest. These were the sessions, and you can kind of ignore where these meetings occurred because if you ask Representative Witt or Representative Wingard, I had these people locked in windowless rooms for literally 60 course hours, and they never saw any of these towns that we were in the whole time we were there. And what was interesting is that it wasn't that much work to keep people in the rooms. They actually were very interested in the content and were drinking through a fire hose, but they were doing it voluntarily. Mm-hmm. The one thing I want to mention here, too, is that we started out with three different face-to-face meetings because the structure of the Institute was in three modules. The first was, how do the energy systems work? You know, what's AC, what's DC, what's single phase, what's three-phase generation? You know, what's upstream, downstream, and midstream in the fossil fuel business and so forth? The second was how you build it. You know, what's the permitting process? What's the financing process? How do you finance a project? What's on-book versus off-book financing? And then the third was how do you run and operate it? And we had both the government folks come in from a regulatory perspective. We had market people come in and talk about market forces on some of these infrastructures. So those were the three modules, and that's why it was broken down between Boise, San Diego, and D.C. These meetings were all embedded with either PennWare meetings or NCSL meetings to help reduce costs. We did an evaluation before people started the course, and we asked them what they knew going in and to self-grade themselves. And then at the end of the course, we also measured them to kind of give us a before and after look. And again, these are areas that through the self-assessment that the group that we had went through actually knew the most and least about according to their own self-assessment. On a scale of 1 to 5, we asked people to rate, you know, the relevancy, saliency, the quality of the presenters, and so forth. And then also, after we collected these ratings, here were the ratings for the different sessions. And we're very pleased that all of them were at least 3 or higher, and most of them were up in the 4 range, which for us was far above what we were hoping for the first, round of this institute. Here's the overall ratings for the different sessions, but this is probably the most telling part, is that by category, how it works, how it's built in finance, and how it's run, you can see the knowledge gain by those three modules by collectively for all the legislators who participated. But here's the individual gains. Most U.S. legislators didn't have a big knowledge of the amount of energy we get, particularly in the West Coast from Western Canada, both not only in fossil fuel but electricity. And you can look at the tremendous knowledge gain that was had in some of these particular topic areas. Finance and energy was one that we actually had people from the private sector that actually covered everything for how you build a merchant-built versus a utility generation to how you actually finance energy efficiency. So that was kind of a broad category. So the pilot project was a success. We're moving forward and having it. We're having a national program with NCSL. 30 seats out of the 60 seats are going to be reserved for Northwest legislators. If we don't fill those 30 seats, then they'll go to the rest of the country to fill in the course. It's quite a value. If you take this course at the University of Idaho, and you do get a certificate from the University of Idaho at the end in energy policy planning for taking the 60 course hours, their fee for the same course runs about $10,500, and this is provided at no cost to the legislators to participate. So it's quite an investment at no cost for the folks that participate. We have a short video to show, but I'd be happy to take questions maybe after the conclusion. And then we have a lot of time, so if you do have time for questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you.
Well, that's we had technical problems in the House, so here we go. And I joked we shot this all on an iPhone, but we actually didn't. It's only 3 minutes.
Hi, this is Jeff Morris, Director of the Pacific Northwest Economic Region's Energy Horizon Project. Each year, infrastructure owners from across the Pinmore region and policymakers gather to talk about the top issues facing the energy sector across the Northwest. Those issues changed, but last year the issue clearly was the fact that policymakers who are lay citizens one day are being asked to decide more and more complex questions that impact our energy future.
We're bombarded with various issues, wide issues, probably nothing more complex than energy and environmental issues, and probably nothing more important right now, particularly with some of the environmental challenges and the economic challenges that we're going through.
So the answer to this was to actually come up with a 101 curriculum that legislators who are committed to energy policy throughout their policymaking career could actually ramp up to speed in a hurry so they knew the right questions to ask and to actually have a foundation of which to make better decisions. You know, really the problem was when infrastructure owners, whether you be a pipeline owner, electrical generation company or distribution company, or an oil or natural gas drilling company, when you come in and talk to a policymaker, if you spend all your time explaining how your systems work, you never get a chance to talk about what the actual problem is and potential solutions.
Well, after participating in the program last year, and really some tremendous programs on the electric side, the generation, the transmission, the difficulty of that, understand the integration of wind into your electric system, I now find myself, I don't have all the answers, but I know what the base questions are, and I know where I can find answers to the questions.
So we put this initial curriculum together. We approached the University of Idaho that had a world-renowned executive utility course for energy, also the Department of Energy and the National Conference of State Legislators to be the founding institute partners in christening this initial project. We also approached the launch sponsors who we couldn't have done this project without, and these represent infrastructure owners both in the electricity and the fossil fuel area.
State, and this has been a phenomenal program. It's given us access to such a broad array of information, and as we know on the energy issues, any decisions we make really impact the future of the energy that's available to the citizens in our state and frankly in the Pacific Northwest.
You are the energy policy leaders in your caucuses, in your states, and in your provinces. And from an industry perspective, particularly mine, I think it's really valuable and important for those policymakers to have a basic, fundamental understanding of how energy industries work.
This is what the Energy Horizon Project is all about. Infrastructure owners and policymakers, energy chairs, and ministers from across the Pacific Northwest region coming together, identifying a challenge, Pinmore proposing a solution, instituting that solution. In the end, we have a core of legislators from across the Pacific Northwest that know the questions to ask and where to get the answers. We're recruiting right now for the 2011 class. We'd love to have you join us.
So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them about that program or Pinmore. But we'd love to have four or five people from Oregon participate in this class and hopefully eventually join our newly formed alumni association. And you would all become vandals as well with your University of Idaho certificate.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, thank you, Representative. Matt, did you want to add a few words? Or?
Yes, we're very excited to be coming to Oregon. And this institute will take place in Portland, July 19 to 22. And we'll have a number of visit policy tours as part of it to Solar World. And we're still open to suggestions from you. But I'd like to thank the work that you've done here, and any insights that you'd like to, you know, as we're forming the curriculum, any best practices that Oregon would like to highlight, we'd like to include them.
Great. Well, thank you, gentlemen. I really appreciate it. Certainly, I certainly wish that this was available when I was starting to learn about energy policy, because it is one of the most complicated areas that I've worked in the whole environmental range of issues. And I used to tell people you think water law was complicated until I started working on energy policy and energy law. So I would strongly encourage my colleagues to look into this, and I'd certainly appreciate all the hard work that you've put into it. Any questions for either of these gentlemen? Okay. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Look forward to seeing you, and good luck back up in Washington.
Thanks.
So with that, I'm going to close the informational meeting on the overview of Penmore. And thank you again, gentlemen, and have a safe trip back, Jeff. And we're going to move on to our public hearing portion of our committee meeting. So with that, I will open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 58. And Beth, if you want to provide an overview.
Madam Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 58 would transfer the Natural Areas Plan and Program from the Department of State Lands and the State Land Board to the Parks and Recreation Department and Commission. The bill would abolish the Natural Heritage Advisory Council and authorize the Parks Department Director to appoint a Natural Areas Advisory Committee to aid and advise in performance and function of the Natural Areas Program. There is no revenue impact. You should have a fiscal impact statement in front of you. And that's all.
Okay. Thank you, Beth. And we have the Director of Department of State Lands, Louise Holliday, who's going to come up and talk about this bill. Yeah, Louise, do you want to? We have other people on this list. Are there other folks that you'd like to
bring parks up at the same time?
Okay, so we'll have John Potter from the Department of Parks and Park Recreation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Louise Holliday, Director of the Oregon Department of State Lands. As your committee administrator indicated, Senate Bill 58 would transfer the Natural Heritage Program and the Natural Heritage Council functions from the Department of State Lands and the State Land Board to the Department of Parks and Recreation and the Parks and Recreation Commission in Oregon. The Council did a review of the Heritage Program, a 25-year review of the program a couple of years ago, and this was one of the recommendations that came out of that review. The Department of State Lands mission is not directly in line with the goals and objectives of the Heritage Program, and the Council, in their 25-year review, recommended that we look at transferring the program to an agency that had a more similar mission. And they recommended looking at a couple of agencies, and we had conversations with those agencies, and the Parks Department seemed to be the best fit, and the Parks Department was willing to take on the responsibilities of this program. This transfer is assumed in the governor's balanced budget in both the parks budget and the state lands department budget, would result in a reduction in our budget. The program transfer would take place on January 1st of 2012, so we would just keep 6 months of funding, and then there would be a reduction in our budget, and parks would pick up that budget starting January 1st of 2012. The other thing I might mention, most of this program is funded with federal grants. There's very little state funding that goes into it, about $25,000 a biennium. The federal grant program is what's called the Section 6 grant program through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Department of State Lands is the designated state agency to receive those Section 6 grants. We pass them through to other organizations who are working to protect some of the important elements that are on these heritage sites and on other sites around the state, and that
designation would transfer from the Department of State Lands to state parks also as a part of this. So the federal grant program would shift to the Parks Department as well. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Why don't we hear first from Parks, and then we'll see if there's some questions.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I'm John Potter, Assistant Director for the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and I'm here to really to support this on the receiving end. We see that this is a relatively small program, but it lines up well with the mission of the Parks and Recreation Department. The Parks Department already owns and manages about 42% of the natural heritage sites that have been designated. It's something that we're used to dealing with every day, and can use existing staff to take up the responsibilities that the Department of State Lands has been doing. We'd pretty much continue the program in its current form, using the Department of State Lands model for how to implement the program. And as Director Soliday mentioned, the governor's recommended budget has a policy option package in it that would have the Parks Department getting limitation for the other funds amount that the Department of State Lands had from lottery funds, and then also picking up the limitation on the federal funding for the grant side. And I would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
So I'm going to start off with a few for either of you to answer. How many FTE, Louise, are currently in the program, and then how many FTE are projected with the transfer? Is that going to change?
So, Madam Chair, we don't have any FTE. We actually contract with the Institute for Natural Resources to do the staffing work for the council. And as I said, we have actually think we have $27,770 in other funds that pays for that staffing.
And are those other funds fees, or what's the source?
Common School Fund funds in our budget.
Okay, and then when the transfer, would you continue contracting with INR, or would you be picking up new FTE?
No, that's our plan. We think there's probably 100 or 200 hours worth of staff time maybe to oversee this. Really not a major FTE issue. And we would use their model of contracting out the predominant amount of work on the project.
So just to clarify, you would use existing FTE for the oversight and then contract out the actual database review requests that come in through the INR?
Yes, Chair.
Institute for Natural Resources, which is located at Oregon State University, just for folks who don't know. Okay, other questions? Senator Haas or Senator Olson?
The Oregon Tribal Council, soon to be the Oregon Tribal Experience, has a heritage tree program. I think history, heritage tree, and it just, you know, I'm a huge fan of both, but I just was wondering about consolidation or dual purposes or cross purposes, and wondered if you had a chance to examine what they do versus what this will do, and if there's a better way to coordinate.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Haas, I believe that's something we could look into. I'm not sure of the details and the components of the Heritage Tree Program, but it's certainly something that we could look at. I'm not sure that that's a major program either, but I do know that there is a group that, or a council or something that oversees that. It is a good program.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Other questions? No? Okay. I think we have a couple more witnesses, and thank you.
Okay, thank you.
For the explanation and your testimony. Jimmy Kagan from Portland State University, and Rick Brown. It's with the Advisory Council. Yeah, from the National Heritage Advisory Council. Thank you, gentlemen. If you could, for the record, state your name, please.
For the record, I'm Jimmy Kagan. I'm with the Institute for Natural Resources, which is now affiliated both with Portland State University and Oregon State University. I have been contracted to staff the Natural Heritage and Natural Areas Program since 1985. I don't have any testimony to make. I was just here to support this effort and to answer any questions that anybody might have. And I'm going to introduce Rick Brown, who's been a member of the council for...
You go ahead, Rick, and we'll see if there's any questions. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Rick Brown. I reside in Portland. I'm a member of the Natural Heritage Advisory Council and have been since around 2000, I think, the last 10 years approximately. And again, similarly, I don't have any prepared comments, but just as a member of the council to answer any questions that you may have.
I guess I'll ask if you support this change. Do you have any comments on it? Or
we do support it. I guess the short version is that we've been fully complicit in the planning for the demise of the council. And as Director Soliday alluded to, it's sort of been a logical, if not a direct linear, consequence of the review, 25-year review that was initiated, I think, in 2004. And so we've anticipated for a while that the most logical outcome would be for the council, as it's currently constituted, to go away.
Okay. Any questions for these gentlemen? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So anybody else would like to testify on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 58. And committee members, this bill has a referral to the Ways and Means Subcommittee.
It does not.
Oh, I thought
it
did.
We need to
add it. Yes. Okay. So this bill, it is recommended that this bill go down to the Ways and Means Subcommittee because it is part of the governor's budget. And so I would like to entertain a motion that moves that to that subcommittee for further review.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 58.
Hold on. First, I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 58.
That's too quick, sorry. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 58 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, Senator Przanski moves Senate Bill 58 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. So is there any discussion on that? Okay. And Senator Thompson, that means we get two bites of the apple. Okay, so with no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hatch?
Aye.
Senator Przanski?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Yes.
Chair Dinkholder?
Aye. So the motion passes, and the bill is sent to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. And just for the new members, I will let you know that we do not assign a carrier here, do we?
Or no.
It's in the Ways and Means Subcommittee is where the carrier will be assigned. And that if it's carried, and that means it also has to go to the full Ways and Means Subcommittee. So we'll eventually see this bill reemerge, possibly. Did you have a question before I close the work session? Okay. So with that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 58. And we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 121. Beth?
Madam Chair, members, Senate Bill 121 increases the maximum annual license fee for retailer seed license and wholesaler seed licenses. The retailer fee cap is raised from $40 to $75, and the wholesaler fee cap is raised from $400 to $750. No revenue impact, and there is a fiscal impact statement, which should be in your packet.
Okay. Thank you, Beth. And I'd like to ask the Department of Agriculture to come up. Lisa Hansen is here to provide an overview on this bill and why this fee increases before us today.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, good afternoon. And for the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And with me, I have Jim Kramer, who is the administrator of our Commodity Inspection Division, in which our seed regulatory program is housed. So the background for this bill, Oregon is known as a leader in the world in terms of the quality of our seed products, especially grass seed. And one of the roles that the Department of Agriculture plays that's quite unique in this is a role of creating a fair playing field in terms of assuring that seed products are labeled accordingly and free of noxious weeds and other potentially harmful seeds. So simply what this bill does is increase the statutory caps in the seed law for retail and wholesale seed dealers. The fees were moved to their statutory cap back in 2000, and so they've been there for quite some time. ODA has worked with the Oregon Seed Council, which is made up of the seed growers and the seed dealers in terms of representation, to bring this proposal forward to you to increase the statutory cap for both of those licenses. It's been discussed quite thoroughly with the organization. And ultimately, if this bill is passed, the plan is then to increase the wholesale seed dealer's license from $400 to $500 post the legislative session, which it really amounts to about a $20,000 per year increase in revenues to the department. And with that, we would be happy to answer any questions about the seed regulatory program or the fee increase.
Jim, did you want to add anything?
Madam Chair, no, I think that's well stated.
So I'll see if there's any questions for the department. We have some other witnesses as well. Any questions?
Just a sure. Quick one.
Sure, Senator Thompson.
Oh, excuse me, Madam Chair.
Thanks.
I'll get better if we don't.
That's okay. Senator Przanski will just nudge you every now and then.
Yeah, he missed me. Let's quick enough. Excuse me. I know what these are about. The fee increase, a lot of it's due to budget cuts and things like this. What happens with that money? What do you use that money for?
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, the seed regulatory program kind of has a multifunctional aspects to it. But
Can you just state your name for the record?
I'm sorry, excuse me. For the record, my name is Jim Kramer, Oregon Department of Agriculture Administrator of the Commodity Inspection Division. Madam Chair and Senator Thompson, the seed regulatory program is kind of a multifunctional program. On the wholesale seed dealer side, we review records and labeling. It's a consumer protection side. Plus, it's Deputy Director Hansen said, it's also to ensure that those folks outside of the state of Oregon that are purchasing Oregon grass seed, that they're getting the highest quality grass seed that's available. And then in addition to that, also we use the funds from the wholesale seed dealer's license to administer the slow pay, no pay law, which you'll probably be hearing more about that in the later in the session. But that's what the funding is used for, Senator Thompson.
Mm-hmm. Other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
If this fee is not implemented, how will that affect your agency?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, probably in the very short term, we'll continue to operate as we do. As those funds decrease in the administration of those programs, we'd have to cut back on those services. And major effect probably would be in our slow pay, no pay law, and that's the ORS 576, so where grass seed growers that have contracts for production with wholesale seed dealers or licensed dealers, where that contract hasn't been honored or followed through with, the department takes on the case on behalf of the growers. So if the funding wasn't available, we would find it very difficult to be able to advocate for the growers and find payment and relief to ensure that the dealers are paid.
Madam Chair, follow-up.
Follow-up.
Would this affect the grass seed growers and their exporting abilities?
Well, Senator Olson, Madam Chair, yes, certainly it would. If our growers aren't being able to be paid for the seed that they're producing, certainly even in the short term, this would have a detrimental effect on their ability to exist as grass seed producers in the state.
Thank you.
Thank you,
and
Madam Chair.
We're going to hear from the industry as well.
Madam Chair.
Yes. I
think it's a follow-up to Senator Olson. Also, if you don't have the ability to ensure the buyers of the quality, that would also have an impact on our market as where we stand out in front today.
Madam Chair and Senator Przanski, absolutely. Oregon's reputation as a high-quality grass seed producer is renowned in the world and is known for the highest quality of grass seeds, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, Senator.
Any other questions for the department? Okay. Thank you very much. I think we're going to hear now from the industry. We have Bill Dunn, who's with the Seed Trade Association's Bill here. You signed up? Yes, Bill, come on up. And Roger Beyer with the Oregon Seed Council. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
For the record, if you can state your name and affiliation, please.
Bill Dunn, President of the Oregon Seed Trade Association and Executive Vice President of Seed Research of Oregon in Corvallis.
Whoever wants to go first.
I'm Roger Beyer, Madam Chair. Thank you for the record, and I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Seed Council. The Oregon Seed Trade is one of the members of the Oregon Seed Council. Madam Chair and the committee, the Oregon Seed Council has worked over the past about 14 months on this issue and others involving the grass seed dealers' licenses and contracting statutes. The department came to us with a request that saying they need to have the license fees increased. We met with our legislative committee, I think, about six times. I think Bill is a member of that committee or has been in the past, and we fully support this bill and raising these fees at this time. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you. Did you want to add anything, Mr. Dent?
As Roger mentioned, Oregon Seed Trade is a member of the Seed Council. The Seed Trade Association that I'm president of is comprised of primarily dealers growing grass seed, forage seeds, wildflowers, native grasses, and specialty seeds. And we've worked, we're kind of a group that's not known for common ground, a lot of opinions strongly held, and in this case we have really a uniform response to it. We value the services and the functions that the ODA performs for the industry. We value not only the quality of the seed, but the quality of the testing that's established under the protocols the ODA enforces. So we consider it valuable, and we totally support it.
Thank you, gentlemen. Let me see if there's any questions for either of you. No? Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming here today and sharing your input. Anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 121? Okay, if not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 121, and I would like to open up a work session. Again, this bill will be going down to the Ways and Means Committee because it's part of the general budget for the Department of Agriculture. So it does already have a referral, is that correct?
It does.
And I will open up a work session on Senate Bill 121. Would you like to make a motion?
Yes,
Vice Chair. I'll entertain a motion.
Chair Dingfelder, I move Senate Bill 121 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 121 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and then it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Any questions? Okay. If the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Hatch?
Aye.
Senator Brzozinski?
Aye.
Thompson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Dingfelder?
Aye. So the motion passes and the bill is sent to the Committee on Ways and Means, and I would close the work session on Senate Bill 121. And again, we're not going to assign a carrier because that will be assigned in the Ways and Means Committee.
I have an off-the-record question. So if we...
We're on the record, but go ahead and ask
yes. Go ahead. You can ask whatever you want, Senator Thompson.
If we say yes to raising a fee and it's because they want us to raise a fee next time we run for election, does that not count against us for raising fees?
Oh, yes. You bet.
Oh, it does. I thought we'd get an exemption or something.
As 15 to 30 second bites and little postcards that you get in the mail.
Yeah.
Well, let some of the gentlemen in the audience answer that question for you who are nodding over there. So with that, we will open up a public hearing on our final bill, Senate Bill 120. And Beth, if you can provide an overview on that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 120 directs the Department of Agriculture to charge annual permit fees to confined animal feeding operations. It establishes a tiered annual fee system, $100 for small CAFOs, $200 for medium, and $300 for large CAFOs. The bill authorizes ODA to adopt a schedule of inspection fees to recover costs of inspections in addition to the regular schedule, and also directs that the definition of small, medium, and large CAFOs be set in administrative rule. There is a fiscal impact statement in your packet and no revenue impact from the bill.
And a prior referral.
There is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Great. Thank you, Beth. So with that, we'll ask Lisa Hansen to come back up, although the director's here, so I don't know if the director... Did you just get back from Hawaii and you don't want to come and talk to us? So we'll ask Lisa Hansen and Mr. Matthews as well. And you may want to start out by explaining what a CAFO is, because I know that there's some people on my committee that are dying to know.
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. And with me I have Wim Matthews, who is the program supervisor for our confined animal feeding operation program. And this is a program within the Department of Agriculture that regulates livestock operations that meet a certain size threshold, as well as have what's known as a wastewater system. And it's simply a program that's put in place for pollution prevention. It assures that animal wastes don't enter surface or ground waters of the state. Oregon was assigned the duties of carrying out the CAFO program quite some time ago. Initially, it was with a WPCF permit in conjunction with DEQ, and in 2000,
which stands for
Wastewater Pollution Control.
They make you say all the acronyms at least for the first couple weeks until you get the.
In 2001, the legislature directed ODA to enter into a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Environmental Quality to move this program over to what is known as an EPA permit. And you want to explain what NPDES is? Because it's not going to roll off my tongue nearly as quickly.
Sure. For the record, my name is Wim Matthews. My first name is spelled W-Y-M. And I'm the program manager for the CAFO program of the Department of Agriculture. So as Deputy Director Hansen told you, the program in 2003 moved to the department under the federal EPA rules to meet those rules, and we were directed to issue a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, that's NPDES permit, that comports with the Clean Water Act and the EPA rules for confined animal feeding operations.
So to continue on, we permit about 560-ish facilities to a general permit in this program. The majority of the facilities, over half of them, are dairy operations, then followed by beef feedlots and poultry operations. There are about 14 different types of livestock operations that are permitted within the program. So to get specifically to Senate Bill 120, this bill is proposed to increase a fee that has been in place for about 25 years. There's been a flat annual fee of $25. It comes to you with a great deal of work with the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association and our agency's CAFO Advisory Committee. And post the 2009 legislative session, the dairy farmers had had many discussions, and we worked with them to come up with what is a tiered fee program that will basically implement $100 for small CAFOs, $200 for medium, and $300 for large. And those are defined by size in our permit. And so with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have, or if you want to know more about the program, I'm sure Mr. Matthews would be happy to explain that.
Okay. What we're going to do is take questions, and then I am going to ask the dairy folks to come up, because I know you're in the process. My understanding is you're in the process of working on an amendment. Is that correct?
Yes. Actually, there is a second part of this, and I meant to say that. The bill in its current form would add a provision to allow the department to have a cost recovery fee. And we have been working again with the industry and the CAFO Advisory Committee. And in recent discussions in the last few days have decided we just don't feel, given a lot of things that are going on in the complexity of trying to put a cost recovery fee into place, we need to spend some more time fleshing this out with them and send it back to the CAFO Advisory Committee and do some more work on it before we move this along. And so if we could request an amendment, and then as well we've been working on with the committee on an emergency clause that would allow us to implement the fee for the next biennium, because that is included in the governor's balanced budget.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that clarification. Are there any questions for the department this time? Senator?
Yep.
Go ahead, Senator Olson.
Then we'll Madam Chairwoman, I noticed on your letter here that you deal with the producers of dairy and livestock. Are there any other contributors under your program, such as poultry?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Olson, we do have several other types of livestock that we permit under this permit. Dairy is the number one holder of those permit registrations. Beef is number two. Poultry is number three.
I can't tell you the exact order, but I can list off for you some of the other species that are registered to the permit. That's swine, horses, dogs. There's a wildlife park, sheep and goats, and fur-bearing animals. That's the majority of the types of facilities that are covered under this permit. And it's all dependent on how many animals they have, how they confine them, and what their waste treatment system is consists of.
A follow-up, please. Is everybody on board with this bill? Livestock, poultry, pigs, swine, chickens, dogs. Ducks, dogs?
Dogs.
Dogs.
Senator Dingfelder, Senator Olson, we've worked very closely with our CAFO Advisory Committee, which is made up of many different permittee organizations, and it has been supported by the CAFO Advisory Committee to move this forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I think we'll hear from some of them today. Senator Hess?
Well, did you say, thank you, did you say dogs? Where are her dogs?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Haas, that's correct. We do have some dog kennel facilities that...
Kennels?
Yeah.
Not individual dogs.
Kennels. They're just
confined in an area.
We're getting the puppies next.
No. Did you have a question, Senator Brzezinski?
I was going to ask about the Dash 2s. I'm assuming this was something that's still a work in progress that we're actually talking about coming back with a dash after that.
Yeah, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Brzezinski, that's correct. It's a pretty simple change.
Okay.
Right, thank you. Any other questions? All right, thank you very much. I'm sure we'll be hearing more about the various livestock.
Thank you.
And actually, I'm going to just ask if Roger Beyer come up with a different hat on. He's with the Oregon Dairy Farmer Association, and Catherine Walker. Changing hats here.
Yep, midstream. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. With me is Catherine Walker, who is the program director for the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. Is that right? I got it right this time. Madam Chair, this proposal, I guess I have to take some credit or blame for it. Last session, as you all were trying to figure out your budget, and many of the legislators on Ways and Means were asking about the CAFO fee and suggesting that this CAFO fee had not been raised in about 20 years, and maybe they should look at that as a source of revenue to fund a program. And I adamantly opposed that idea at that time on behalf of the dairy farmers, but I made the commitment that I would work with the industry and work with the department in the interim to see if we could come to some agreements on how we could raise this fee and if it was when the time was right. The dairy industry has been in very tough times for the last couple of years. The hope would be that by the time we got back here in January of 2011, the dairy industry would be in a better position and have a little more, a little better cash position than it had been in 2009. Unfortunately, that isn't the case, but we did come to this agreement, and we're sticking by it. Having said all that, the industry has worked hard amongst itself to get to this agreement of the small, medium, and large flat fee. The issue of the stop charges or additional charges and above those fees has not been as well settled, I will say, amongst the dairy industry at least. I'm not going to speak for the other industries. And we have not been able to reach agreement among ourselves that this would be the right time to implement a program like that. And in recent conversations with the department, we actually tried to come up with some scenarios we could agree with, and the more we talked, the more complicated it got, and we realized that it would not be appropriate this time to try to implement that part of it. So we would ask that lines 12 through 15 of the bill be stricken at this time, and we will work on that for another 2 years. So that would be the amendment that would be addition to the Dash 2 amendment that is in for you now. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions on the bill or what's happened, or and let Catherine talk about the what she's done for the industry also.
Welcome. Thank you for coming here today.
For the record, I'm Catherine Walker, Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. I'm a former CAFO inspector. I worked for the Department of Agriculture for 3.5 years. Just here to echo support for the tiered fee and structure. But Madam Chair and members of the committee, we'd love to see this bill signed by May 15th.
before the billing cycle for the department. This would make not only life easier for the department, it would not create an extra financial burden for the department having to go back charge producers, and it'd also just be simpler for the folks who are receiving the bill just to get one bill.
Thank you. And I see the language under Section 2 to try to address that.
Yes, ma'am.
In the Dash 2 amendments.
Yes. Yes.
In addition to the emergency clause.
If we were certain the bill would be passed and signed by May 15th, we wouldn't need that amendment.
Well, I cannot speak for the other committees, but I can say our committee works pretty efficiently. But we certainly hope to move it out way before that if there's agreement on these amendments. So thank you. We'll see if there's any questions for either of these witnesses.
Madam Chair.
My vice chair has a question, Senator Olson.
These increases are not substantial, but would they put a financial burden on any of the dairies or recipients of these bills?
Well, I guess it depends on your definition of substantial, Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair. Where the current fee from $25 to only $100, $200, $300 may not seem like much, but for many dairies, and I won't speak to other organizations, but many dairies have more than one capital permit. Every facility has to have a separate permit. So they may have their milking cows in one place and their non-milking cows in another and their heifers or their calves in another. So they may have multiple permits. So they were currently they're paying $25 in each. One dairy I know, for instance, is going from a $75 annual fee to $750 annual fee with this program.
$700
annual fee. So it's actually a pretty significant increase in many cases.
Follow-up?
Madam Chair, follow-up. I apologize for saying they're not significant, but you didn't. The question I asked was, will it have a financial impact on those farmers that have to bear the burden of this? If they carry many CAFO permits, is it going to cause them problems?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Vice Chair, Senator Olson, excuse me. Of course, the answer is yes. On average, for the past 2 years, Catherine, make sure my number is right, dairy farmers have been losing approximately $1,000 per cow per year. The price of milk has been below the price of feed and care for the animal. Certainly, it's going to have an impact on them. We believe that the industry is going to rebound, and when it does, it will be much better. But absolutely, it will be a financial hardship. But at the same time, the CAFL program is very important to the dairy industry. Our farmers recognize the need of this program. This program is a model nationwide on how to run these things, and we want to make sure it's whole and healthy, and we need to do this in order to make sure it's whole and healthy.
Do you have another follow-up?
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair, if you deal with the dairy industry, what about the other industries like chickens, poultry, and pigs and swine? Do they carry many CAFO permits?
Madam Chairman, Senator Olson, like agriculture, CAFO permits are unique and diverse to each commodity. I'm not the expert in poultry. Farms in general carry one permit. In dairy, some operations have two or three permits. Like Roger explained, there may be cows on one facility, and in order to expand the operation and gain more land base, they may purchase a neighbor's farm and then move heifers off site. And so they have two permits. But in general, most folks have one permit.
We're actually going to hear from Jim Welsh next, who can speak for the cattle industry, and we may call ODA back up if they want to talk about the impact on poultry. So any other questions for Senator Frazanski?
Roger, what I'm hearing from your testimony, if this program doesn't continue, we're going to see more detrimental effect on the industry itself by losing the program?
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, the potential is there. I can't say it will happen, but Oregon is one of the few states that the producers have not been sued for violations of Clean Water Act, and we believe that the CAFL is because they haven't been sued here. So that's why we support the program wholeheartedly and want a sound program and needs to go forward.
So in other words, you don't want a full employment act for attorneys.
Don't tell him that. All right. Thank you very much, and thank you for coming here today.
Thank you.
Next up is Jim Welsh, and then Lisa, do you want to come back up and address, since you've been working with the poultry industry, and we don't have anybody here from the poultry industry, so maybe, I don't think, do we have anybody in the audience today from the poultry, representing the poultry industry? Okay. Jim?
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, Jim Welsh, with today representing Oregon Cattlemen's Association and Beef Northwest. Beef Northwest is one of the largest beef feeder lots in Boardman in the state of Oregon. And I have represented not only Beef Northwest, but the cattlemen on the advisory committee, too. So, and I had the great experience of learning a lot about NPDES and the permitting when I came on board with the cattlemen, and they wanted me to serve on this advisory committee. And then we went in through some rule changes and updating and revising the program and learned an awful lot about it. And I guarantee you our people who have CAFOs and our organizations support this program, very well managed by ODA. And we see this is certainly protection not only for certainly our waters under the Clean Water Act. It is very important for our state, for clean water, our fisheries, and everything else. But also, you know, it is, as it's administered and written, it is a protection for our industry, for our CAFOs. And I have to tell you, though, that if I were to send a survey out to the CAFOs and members of my organization and ask them if they'd want a fee increase, you know what they would say. It's tough times. But this is a program that, you know, every time we talk about it, every time we work with ODA, everybody really is supportive, and we've got to have it. It is very important for us. So, you know, what we say is it's hard. We have no recorded opposition against these fee increases to this date. As I say that, you would probably get the blame for this.
Yeah, we get blamed for everything.
Forward.
You know that.
Exactly. So, you know, as soon as if it hits papers or anything else, you know, it everybody, you know, we might hear some opposition. But, you know, I've talked to Wim, and he said that, you know, the biggest share of those that are regulated under these permits know about this. And we've talked to our members and everything else. And we would look for opposition. We always do. And we haven't had any. Okay.
Well, thank you for testifying. Appreciate that. I do, but you do bring up a good question, and I do have a question then for ODA, is how do you intend to notify all the CAFO holders, current CAFO holders? And obviously, not everybody knows about the current negotiations and task force and work groups that have gone on. So can you maybe talk about how you're going to plan to get the word out, obviously through the different associations that you work with, but for the individual owners who may not be a member of those associations?
For the record, Lisa Hansen again, Chair Dingfelder. To give you a little better sense of the background and the outreach that's gone into building this up, ODA spent a significant amount of time during 2010 with the Oregon dairy farmers attending several of their meetings. Dairy farms make up 294 of the 560-some permittees in this program. So that's a really big chunk of them. I think it's been quite well vetted within the dairy industry. Beef feedlots, the cattlemen, are about 122 of the permittees. And I know that it's been spoken to at the Oregon Cattlemen's Association as well and vetted there. Granted, not everybody is a member, but that's, again, one of the ways we've done this. In terms of poultry, there are 40 fryer meat poultry operations that are registered to the permit, and there are 8 egg-laying facilities that are registered to the permit. We have the layers, they're a pretty small community of people. One of their representatives sits on the CAFO Advisory Committee, and they're pretty tight-knit. And I recently, as a week ago, had visited with 2 of the major facilities, and I think there's 4 in the state. So our annual renewals go out on May 15th. And that's typically one of the ways when people receive their bills. We surely can, if this bill is to move forward, to send out a notice to all the permittees. They have annual reports that are due, I believe it's in March.
March 15th.
And remind them then that the fee increase is coming forward with those May 15th renewals.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for either Jim? Did you want to make another comment, Jim?
Just a quick comment, Chair Dingfelder. We were here before you in 2009 and asked for a fee increase for our brand department, and we've been in that position for programs that we have to have, and you voted. Even in 2009, we knew it was economically a very tough period of time, and you have helped us before. And when we have to have some programs, and those are programs that are fee-based, that we support, and there aren't any general fund monies going in some of those programs, the ones we had for the brand department last time, it was our program. And so we've been here before, and it's tough. It's not easy, but we got to have the programs.
Well, we appreciate you stepping up, because you're right. It was tough last session. It's going to be even tougher this session. So thank you for coming forward, and same for the other members of the work group for supporting it. And Roger, your members. Other questions? Okay, it looks like you'll be back working on that amendment, and so I know you'll keep my committee staff informed, and we'll look forward to seeing you back here for work session.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 120? All right. With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 120. Stay tuned for the work session. Will be posted when we get that amendment. And with that, I will close the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, and we'll see you all next week.